Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Interesting, mate. Yeah.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Fighting Cock, The Extra Inch. Just a reminder, first off, that the podcast feed is now live. Please do subscribe. Follow the Twitter account, The Extra Inch. Thank you so much for all the reviews and ratings so far. It's very much appreciated. If you could take 5 minutes to leave us a rating and a review, it'd really help us out. We are once again recording at the wonderful SNK Studios in London. Many, many thanks to Cave from the Owen the Spurs podcast, who always makes us so welcome. I think he might be the nicest man in the world. This time, though, we've been demoted to a different, slightly smaller office studio space because Cave has have other clients who actually pays him money. So we've had to sacrifice Nathan, only metaphorically, but it means you won't hear Nathan's dulcet tones this time. But Bardi is here, my sidekick and best friend. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy. How are you doing?
I'm good. And we're delighted to welcome Priya Ramesh. Priya is a football writer for The Guardian, The Blizzard and Benefit, amongst other publications, and is widely seen as a Dutch football expert, I think it's fair to say. You may have heard her previously on The Fighting Cock discussing Vincent Janssen and then Davinson Sanchez with Flav. I think we'll come back to both of those later. Priya, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Good to see you. So I think we'll start off by talking about you. You've made the effort to calm down. Talk to us about how you got into football and your relationship with football growing up.
Well, I'm probably a lot younger than many people realise. So I actually grew up like in the 2000s, there used to be a anime, like a Japanese cartoon called Captain Tsubasa. Interestingly, the creator of which I got to interview for the Blizzard last summer, and it was one of the best kind of experiences of my life, just coming like full circle, because that anime was really about like just this kid in Japan who really loves football and goes on to great things, and plays for a club that is like Barcelona but not Barcelona because they had copyright issues with the anime. And he had like a lot of characters were based off of real life footballers and managers. So you had a character I think called Eric Van Saal, who is a disciplinarian coach at Barcelona. We can guess who that is based off. And that was kind of my entry into football, and I kind of started playing now and then, and just really enjoying the sport. A few years later. When I was around 8, we moved to the Netherlands. We moved to Amstelveen, which is around 30, 40 minutes from the centre of Amsterdam, and kind of same distance from the Amsterdam Arena where Ajax play. So, I actually went to school with the sons of Patrick Kluivert and...
Oh, wow.
Shota Arveladze, but Patrick Kluivert, not the one that's currently turning up for Ajax's elder brother, I started playing there, but I wasn't like any good. I was just kind of started playing for fun, and then I moved around a bit more, and then just kind of started blogging, just for the fun of it. Really, I just really was one of those kids who wanted their opinion known and, like, wanted to put it out there. So I just really started writing because I wanted to get, like, some of my opinions down in words and put it out there and, like, see what other people thought. And it was a very kind of unexpected one step led to another. And, you know, in 2014, I got the... Well, 2013, I think. No, 2014. 2014, I got the chance to write for Benefit, which is It is a Dutch blog. It's not a Dutch blog, sorry. It's a blog concerned with Dutch and Belgian football. I sent an email to the editor there in the summer before the World Cup asking if I could contribute to the site. And apparently he wasn't using that email anymore, so it was purely by chance that even, like, he came across my email. And then he encouraged me further. I started writing for them, and then he said you should probably, like, you know, try to write for bigger publications. So December 2014, I got published in 442, and then the following year got published in The Guardian, and then it's just kind of been a really insane ride. Last year I got published in the Blizzard, which was kind of a long pipeline dream for me. It's a very unexpected journey even for me. I still find it pretty surreal.
It's a huge achievement for someone to do this, not only so young as you are, but also just as a hobby, you know. And there's people who do this for a career and spend hours every day trying to do the things you've done as a hobby, which I think is incredible.
So, well, it also kind of makes me feel guilty, and I feel like, am I taking away, like, the chance of someone who's worked a lot harder for this? So it's kind of just grappling with that and, recognising that I'm at a place now where, you know, there are many more people who put in a lot more effort, and I'm just like, am I just kind of, like, floating around here?
It's a nice place to be, though.
I quite like the fact that you went to school, the same school as Patrick Kluivert and Shota Avaladze's kids, and that was not Justin Kluivert, it was an older brother.
It was his elder brother,
so his
Quincy.
Dad was, like, an amazing footballer.
Yeah,
his,
yeah, yeah.
His little
yeah,
brother's an amazing footballer. What was he? Just a class clown?
Well, kind of. But I think, if I'm not wrong, at the start of the season, he was training with the Vitesse Youth Academy, so I'm not sure where that's gone, but his younger brother is pretty good for Ajax currently, but the real star of the family is the youngest brother, Shane Kluivert, who has, like, his own Instagram and, like, his own YouTube channel. I think he's, like, 9 years old, and got his own contract with Nike. I'm not even sure if, like, he will become a really good footballer, but he's got a really good kind of, like, YouTuber media career in the making.
Wow.
Because this weekend we had Kevin Campbell's son and Peter Schmeichel's son playing up against each
that's
other.
Right.
And that made me feel really old.
Yeah, I felt exactly the same. Is it Tyrese Campbell?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah. And he plays the same position as well.
Yeah.
Well, as does Kasper Schmeichel.
Because he's a striker at Stoke, obviously. I just found out it's 2 years to the day, I think, or maybe 3 years since Berahino actually scored a goal. So I thought it was quite nice little stuff.
I always sort of feel a little bit sorry for players who play in the same position as their famous parents, especially in Kasper Schmeichel's case. You've got a lot to live up to, but he's won the league, so he can't really complain, can he?
As we're talking about people with famous dads and stuff, I wanted to ask Priya who her favourite ever Dutch footballer is.
The obvious choice is Johan Cruyff, who obviously I haven't seen live, but you know, having seen, like, old videos of games and matches and all that.
Because which national team do you support? I get the impression you are a Holland fan. Yeah.
I watched Euro 2008 on a boat. I think it was like a school camp or something, but we were like on a boat and just jumping up and down when they beat France in the group stages. I think my favourite out of the ones I've watched is probably Arjen Robben, just because he's so good at what he does. Mm-hmm. And he's not like the kind of archetypal Dutch footballer. So he's probably up there with personal favourite Klaas-Jan Huntelaar as well. But in terms of who was consistently good at the top and made difference, it's just genuinely, he's 30 or 33 now. And until you know, sometime late 2017, he was still one of like the best footballers for country and club, which is ridiculous. But I also really like Frank Rijkaard, because I think when it comes to the kind of pavilion of great Dutch footballers, he tends to always come behind the likes of Gullit and Van Basten. Mm-hmm. But I think he was a much more all-round footballer and just had immense talent. Not many people can claim to finish their career the way he has, by going back to the club that you started, or not really started out, but mm-hmm. sort of started out at, and winning the Champions League with basically the last kick you'll ever play in the game.
And beating it was his old team as well,
yeah,
in the final, Milan.
Absolutely.
But that was a beautiful Ajax team that had Cliver, Davids, all those kind
Lippmannen.
Of guys.
Lippmannen. One of the things that I kind of feel sad about is the fact that English fans just remember Lippmannen as the kind of guy who was always injured at Liverpool. But he was so good for Ajax. It's no kind of mean feat filling Dennis Bergkamp's shoes once he left for Inter Milan. But the way Louis van Gaal talked about him was amazing. He used to fawn over Lippmannen.
He was pretty good at Liverpool. I mean,
glimpses, wasn't it? He never really fully got going because, like you say, he was constantly injured, so it interrupted his spell there.
And he was an absolute nerd. Like, I was reading, I found this out when I was reading Simon Cooper's book, I think it was Football Men. And Lippmannen was an absolute football nerd. He used to collect like pieces of trivia and go to quizzes in Amsterdam along with Danny Blind and take part in them. And it's quite amazing to see someone who like really enjoyed the game, enjoyed playing it, obviously, but also just learning about it and just, you know, facts and things like that.
Is that fairly typical of players that play in the Netherlands, would you say? I'm saying this because I think I could be completely wrong. I get the impression that Dutch footballers and footballers that play in the Netherlands are slightly more academic in a sense and have a really good broad understanding of the game.
I think that is true to an extent, but I don't think it necessarily kind of makes them superior in any sense, because I actually think Davinson Sanchez and Matthijs de Ligt, one of them was talking about it last year before the Europa League final, about how it's nice knowing that the Dutch footballers are intelligent and can think of things. Yeah, Sanchez was talking about this, that Dutch players always have the thought before what they do. But sometimes you just have to kind of go in for it and have a sense of, you know, instinctive reactions to what happens in the game. And this is a massive like national conversation in the Netherlands as well, in terms of how we need to change youth football in the Netherlands to kind of produce the great players that we had, and why is like the production line kind of stalling and stagnating in producing players who are slow, not as kind of adventurous in possession. And I think it's a pretty not really damning, but a pretty stark contrast between players who've left the Netherlands, who left the Eredivisie recently, but between the ones that were entirely educated in the Netherlands and came to the Netherlands when they were 16 to like 20. So if you think of like Alderweireld, Vertonghen, Eriksen, Sanchez, and even, you know, the guy who's kind of one of the best players now, Herving Lozano, they all come. You can even go back to like Luis Suarez. They all came at a point when they wanted, they had the raw talent and needed some education, some like honing. But if you think about like Memphis Depay, who I still absolutely love to bits, but and someone like Davy Klaassen, who's currently, you know, in the wilderness at Everton, there is a kind of difference in the make of the footballer that's coming out of the Netherlands currently and the ones that come out of Dutch clubs in their Dutch youth systems. And there's like, I'm not smart enough to analyse and kind of diagnose what's wrong with that, but there is a certain overhaul that's needed at that level in the Netherlands currently to bring about this change. And I guess you can partly see it in the current Ajax kind of generation of De Ligt and Van der Beek, And even Nori, you know, I mean, God bless him, and I still wish him well. And they were kind of very individual players in the mould that used to come out, and that's partly because of the likes of Wim Jonk, who came back to the club in 2008, sorry, and was part of the Cruyff revolution that happened, and he kind of changed the way the youth system worked a bit and focused more on the individual and making them a lot more complete in their skill set. So it'll be interesting to see how that generation progresses and, you know, whether they can match up and make up for a sort of lost generation between after the likes of Robin and Schneider.
What you've just said there about Wim Jonk, that's exactly kind of how it started with Spurs as well. So one of the reasons we wanted to get Priya on was to talk about the relationship that Spurs have had with Ajax. But I think it's worth mentioning also the link with Vilkova, who taught the... I'm butchering that name, I think. Was that OK? I got the thumbs up. I think I did it OK. He was brought into Spurs when Frank Arnesen was director of football under Martin Jol.
Well, the link between Ajax and Spurs goes back even further than that. So you're talking about Vic Buckingham, who went there in the 60s, who was a teammate of Arthur Rowe, the famous push and run. And relating to what Priya was saying earlier, when he arrived in Holland, he found a group of players who didn't want to boot the ball, who wanted to pass the ball. So it has been something that's been there, part of their ethos from the start.
I think Cruyff mentions this in his autobiography, is that he learnt one of the biggest lessons he got from Buckingham was English. He used to hang around at the Buckingham household, and that's how he picked up English, by just kind of being there in that surrounding.
Because he was a 17-year-old kid, I think.
He gave him his debut.
Called him his second son, and they linked up. Basically, Buckingham kind of... I'm going to butcher this name. Rinus Michels.
Yeah.
And he kind of like was the forefather each at Ajax and then later on at Barcelona. So I think Spurs and Ajax are like kind of intrigued, like we're linked.
Intrinsically linked. And that was kind of the Dutch kind of revolution, as it were, at Spurs started again in 2005 when we appointed Ricardo Muniz as a skills trainer. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But it was when Martin Jol was our head coach. And Jol said of Muniz, he's one of the few proteges of the skills training guru, Vilkova. We are delighted to welcome him to our staff. And it was such an important appointment because he then spent the next year and a bit indoctrinating our coaching staff into his particular coaching method, which was the Kurver method. And basically this is, I've written about this before, so I'm quite interested in it. The centre of the model is that technique and skill can be taught in a kind of academic manner rather than just through technical ability being a natural phenomenon. And it's essentially about prioritising a player's touch and teaching 1v1 tricks, breaking all these moves down into smaller plays and then slowly putting those together to become plays is a very American sporting term, but I think it makes sense in this sense. And then slowly combining these and linking these movements to make up the game of football, as it were. So it's kind of breaking them down and then rehearsing them one by one to a point where players improve technically. And Arnesen and probably Jol obviously identified Muniz, who was one of the few remaining teachers of this method, got him to Spurs, and he came in as what was called a skills coach, but it obviously became so much more than just teaching skills. And it was really about teaching the academy coaches how to coach young players, and I think that's been bearing fruit at Spurs for quite a while now. Certainly in the Livermore, Colker, Adam Smith and Andros Townsend crop, and you could argue Ryan Mason and Tom Carroll, They were the first players that I saw who had probably shown signs of the Muniz effect and were technically better than the previous year's output from the academy. And since then, we've been developing these technically superior players. And I think a lot of it has to do with what the coaches at Spurs are teaching. And a lot of it does go back to Muniz and what he was doing. I mean, the sad thing was with Muniz, he's gone on to change his career. He's become a manager himself. and has been pretty unsuccessful. And I sort of think, stick to what you're good at, Ricardo. You know, you're really good at skills coaching. That's something you do superbly well.
A bit like Andre Villas-Boas should have.
Absolutely. Stick to your dossiers.
As a scout, instead of being a football manager or a rally car driver.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's this...
How did that go? Did the Dakar rally?
He had to pull out. Yeah. He got injured, I think, and dropped out. Huh. Who would have thought he actually would do that after he said it? I mean, I really thought that was just like a whimsical thing he said in a press conference, but no, he actually did it. Anyway, we digress. I mean, Muniz has done nothing as a manager. He ended up at Notts County for a while. And that was probably what he's best known as.
Some of the best coaches don't make it as a manager. Steve McLaren is someone who's linked to Holland as well. He's always getting praised as a coach, but as a manager, he hasn't been great.
That's a great point. And we always see when an academy manager does well.
I think that's an important distinction, because in the Netherlands, they don't call the manager, as we know them, they don't call him the manager, they call them the head coach, because that's the role that you're given within the club, is to coach these players to be better. Not kind of the word manager kind of goes back to the days where they kind of handled all of player recruitment and everything. But now it's very much head coach, which, is kind of better delineation of duty, I guess.
Which I think was a title Pochettino had at Spurs for a long time. But I think that has been technically, I think it's changed to manager.
It
now,
is,
it?
Yeah. He had an upgrade to manager, if you see it as an upgrade, that is. I mean, I think that shows the bond he has with Daniel Levy and the trust that Levy has in him to take a more holistic approach to the club.
But it's also maybe the Anglification of Pochettino, where he needs to be a manager, because there is an obsession in this country of a manager has to be in charge of everything.
He does seem a bit of a control freak as well in many ways, I suppose. He's very meticulous with his preparation, and I'm sure he's fine at delegating duties to his coaching staff, but there's something in that. So obviously we've spoken about the links with Dutch football and with Ajax. It's kind of odd that we've got four previous Ajax players in our books at the moment and four of our best players.
I would like to take this moment to talk about a few other Ajax players at Spurs.
Please do.
Van der Vaart.
Van der Vaart, of course. Mido. Edgar Davids, who no one asked me who my favourite Dutch player of all time was, but I loved Edgar Davids. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant player. And we got him at the end of his career.
He's just recently been appointed the assistant coach for the Dutch under-20 team.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. Good for him. Because even at Barnet, I think there's a story. And on an away game, he drove past a group of Barnet fans that had broken down, and he paid for them all to get home and looked after them. And I remember him joining Spurs, and even at that kind of advanced age, he actually came in. I hold him responsible for kind of turning Spurs around from being a very soft team to a team that actually challenged and, well, pushed us very close to top four. And also Munir El Hamoudi as well.
El Hamdawi.
Yeah.
He played with Moussa Dembélé at AZ.
Okay.
Yeah, they were teammates. And I remember this very clearly because I had a sticker book at the time. like a supermarket, every 10 euros you spend, you get a pack of stickers. Mm-hmm. And I accidentally stuck Moussa Dembélé in Munir El Hamdoui's place.
Yeah.
And then I still regret this to this day. Instead of just going ahead and sticking Munir in Moussa's place, I stuck him on top of Moussa.
How could you do that to Dembélé?
My God, I still regret this. It is one of the biggest regrets I still have to this day.
So I got a question. Did you ever see Dembélé the striker?
Yeah.
What was Dembélé the striker like?
Very skillful. I'd recommend... because it's brilliant, because the Eredivisie have recently uploaded like a whole archive of videos that you can go and look up. But I'd recommend looking up his goal for AZ against his former side, Willem II. Mm-hmm. He basically starts somewhere just near the edge of the box, slaloms past like five or six players, and then dinks it like past the keeper. And it's very like it's Maradona-esque, and It's still very kind of interesting to me that he's now one of the best holding midfielders, the best kind of destroyers in the world, and it's a very interesting marriage of skill, I think, between his ability to dribble, which he still retains, and the fact that he's gotten so good at kind of just moving past people and like breaking the opposition lines without even looking like he's putting in much effort. He just kind of glides on the pitch. And even when he kind of goes in for a tackle, it doesn't look like a kind of crunching action. It's kind of it's kind of like an assured, he knows he's going to get the ball, and, you know. And yeah, I mean, actually, continuing on from Dembele, more than Ajax, I think you should be grateful to a Belgian club called Germinal Beerschot, which is where not only Vertonghen and Alderweireld, but also Dembele and Victor Wanyama got their starts. Because, okay. That club, Germinal Beerschot and Ajax, had a partnership, which is how the likes of Vermaelen and Alderweireld and Vertonghen came to Ajax.
Okay.
Interesting. And were they at what age did they join Ajax?
I think Vertonghen joined in 2003 and I think Toby joined the following year. Yeah. So they must have been around 16, I guess. Yeah. And it's interesting because when Germinal Beerschot went for... went and eventually got Vertonghen. They went for the other Vertonghen. They went for his elder brother, Ward, who was the striker. But they saw Jan, who was playing in midfield. He was a midfielder for a long time, maybe until like 2008, I think, before he was moved back to central defence. But yeah, they saw him and then picked him up instead, and that's how the kind of route to Ajax began. And there was an interesting point very early on in his career where he got loaned out to... Oh, I can't remember the club. I think it was RKC Waalwijk. And it was a 2006-07 season. They were playing Ajax. Ajax, this is a season where three Eredivisie clubs went into the last day of the season with a chance of winning the title. And it was very close, and in the end it was PSV who won it. But AZ and Ajax came very close as well. And I think three games from the end of the season... So in the Netherlands, if you're loaned out to a club, you can still play against your parent club. So Vertonghen played for RKC Waalwijk against Ajax, and he scored, and Ajax drew the game, and the manager at the time was Henk ten Cate. And he apparently went to Vertonghen in the tunnel after the game and was like, "You'll never play for Ajax in your life. This is it. You can't do this to your club. You will never play for Ajax again." But he was sacked, so it didn't make a difference in the end.
The new manager forgot. I didn't know about it in the first place, so he got away with that one. It's quite interesting that he started as a midfielder, because that's one of the key concepts of total football is the... ability to fill in other positions, right? That's like the main thing, is you're flexible, and when one player moves out of his position, you can slot in. And I think we see that throughout the Spurs team. There's a huge amount of flexibility. Pochettino clearly values versatility incredibly highly, and all of the players that we've signed from the Netherlands have that in spades. Alderweireld has basically only ever played as a centre-back for us, but he's played loads in holding midfield, at right back throughout his career. He's a very, very versatile player. Vertonghen's obviously played various positions for us: midfield, left wing back, left back, centre back. Eriksen can pretty much play anywhere across the midfield happily. I mean, he's even improving now to the point where you'd think he could probably hold his own in a double pivot.
I've got a question on Alderweireld. How come he ended up at Southampton then Tottenham? Because I know he went to Atletico Madrid. Was there a perceived drop off in performance, or was there something that happened in his career that kind of put him towards Southampton then to us?
I think it was... I'm not entirely sure if Tottenham were interested in him in that window, but I personally think it's because of the... partly because of the black box system that the Southampton have in terms of replacing players. And I guess Lovren mm-hmm. that he replaced, and I'm not entirely sure if the fact that Ronald Koeman was manager had a part to play in it, because obviously he'd seen Alderweireld at close quarters when he was manager at Feyenoord, PSV and then Feyenoord, so he kind of charted Alderweireld's growth in the Netherlands. And I actually think Koeman's kind of presence had an effect on quite a few signings. There, you look at Tadic, Pella, even Sadio Mane, because Mane absolutely annihilated Ajax in the Europa League And I think a lot of people in the Netherlands kind of perked up at the fact that Mane joined Southampton then. And I think he definitely found it hard in Madrid with Atletico, because he's talked about this as well. And is the fact that he'd gone from this total football, well, not really total football, but because it's still kind of a very watered down version of it at Ajax. Currently, nothing can kind of match up to the level it was. But it was a very drastic change in style for him, going from this side where he had a lot of time on the ball and he could go forward and help with creating play to Simeone's kind of, you know, I just, when I think of Simeone, I think of, you know, the ancient Romans used to have this military kind of formation called the Tortuga, I think.
The
tortoiseshell, yeah. And that's kind of what I envision Simeone's side to be at some point, is a very kind of compact structure where you leave no gaps for the opponent to get you. And I can understand, it's understandable to see how that would be quite a big difference for him, even if Frank de Boer was actually one of the better coaches in the Eredivisie at making defenders better. And I think he struggled with that, and he struggled with the fact that he couldn't break through in the team with Godin and Miranda in the centre of defence. And obviously the fact that he came on in the Champions League final and then everything fell apart for Atletico Madrid. I think he's also kind of, the personality that we kind of got from him at Ajax was a bit softer than Jan Vertonghen. And I think he struggled with like homesickness and stuff when he first came to Ajax as a teenager as well. And I think he just needed a team at that point where he knew he'd be getting games, and he knew the style of football would suit him. So at Southampton, because, you know, Koeman plays that kind of football where, in his first season and second season as well, first season especially, I thought Southampton were quite impressive in the first half of the season. And you could see how that kind of helped him build his confidence a bit more. And I think that's definitely played a role in his growth back at Spurs, because that allowed him to find his feet again. And then in a league where he kind of knew the way now, he could then go to Spurs in a better team and get the opportunity to both develop himself as a player and help a team that was quite exciting at the time, and it still does still have a lot of potential.
Mm-hmm. Are they both, I presume Alderweireld and Vertonghen, are both held with a great deal of affection by Ajax fans?
Vertonghen especially, because he was captain for a while, and one of the kind of defining images I can still remember is so in the 2010-11 season, when Frank de Boer took over in December 2010, that was the first season that Ajax had won the title, I think, in 6 or 7 years, and it came down to kind of played out where the last match day was essentially a final, because the two teams who had a chance of winning a title were playing against each other, FC Twente at the Amsterdam Arena against Ajax. And I think it was at full time when the whistle blew and Vertonghen basically collapsed into the floor clutching his Ajax shirt, and he was crying, he was in tears, and it kind of really showed that he was Belgian, yes, but he seemed to understand the club as much as like someone who had been born and brought up in Amsterdam and grew up with, you know, to borrow a cliche, like the club in his blood and things like that. And I think he did get into trouble for letting that get the better of him, I think, in 2010 when they won the Baker, the kind of cup, the domestic cup under Martin Jol, and I think the Ajax like do a kind of parade and ceremony and stuff, and Vertonghen called they beat Feyenoord in the final as well, so he insulted Feyenoord fans, let's put it that way. Don't want to repeat what he said, but it was a not particularly tasteful chant that some of the extreme sections of the Ajax fandom have for Feyenoord. And he did get kind of punished for that from the club and the association as well. But I think that kind of also endeared him a lot to the kind of hardcore Ajax fans.
So interesting to hear you speak of Vertonghen in terms of showing his emotion on the pitch, because so often we've seen him as the Iceman and he's been referred to as having a bit of an attitude problem and being a bit moody. And Pochettino's come out recently and sort of said he's been working on Vertonghen's attitude and trying to get him to show the right body language on the pitch. But clearly that was something he had, certainly in his Ajax days. And perhaps it was the link with the club. And that was maybe what was missing at Spurs, particularly when Tim Sherwood was in charge. And he probably felt like he was going nowhere and drifting. And maybe that's something to do with Pochettino's style of management. He's kind of brought not only the fans back on side with the direction of travel with the club, but the players too, and they all feel like they're buying into it more, and Vertonghen's grown in that respect.
Yeah, I was going to mention the Vertonghen body language. There was the game at Liverpool where he looked very like uninterested, and there was comments from Sherwood post-Chelsea about his attitude. But I'm also quite curious about Christian Eriksen, because I've seen you mention quite a few times on Twitter that the price Spurs got Eriksen for is an outrageous amount of money.
Oh my God. I have a Spotify playlist of sad songs, and that the cover picture for that is Eriksen holding a sweatshirt.
Yep.
Genuinely just because it was an absolute bargain price for someone who we knew that from the age of, you know, 19 or 20 was already destined to go to, like, that's partly something I was upset with, was the fact that he didn't go for a bigger club and none of the bigger clubs wanted him. I think there was talk of Borussia Dortmund at that point, but that was the time when they got Mkhitaryan instead. So negotiations there broke down and he ended up going to Spurs. But I still kind of can't believe that Mark Overmars let him go to Spurs for 11 million. It's just, it's still implausible for me. It's kind of made up for it by the fact that Ajax have gotten good returns on the likes of Milik and Sanchez as well. But I still can't believe that. It's partly to do with the fact that he was in the last year of contract and all that, but you tell me all of this, you explain all the logic to me, I get it, but it's still 11 million. So, like, one of the best talents in the world at that point, and who has, you know, not really moved away from what we expected of him, in that he's now one of the best midfielders in the world. And I'll say that without a shred of doubt, because he definitely is one of the best midfielders, you know, one of the best in this position.
He can do things with the football that many players can only dream of doing. He's a magician. I must admit, I had my doubts with Eriksen at times.
I've gone through moments with Eriksen as well.
I've had peaks and troughs with him. And I think I was probably hard on him because I saw him as being experienced despite his age, because he started so young. And so you kind of apply logic that you wouldn't normally apply to a player of his age. And that was unfair of me. It was irrational to assume that he can do things that a 26, 27-year-old could do. He was 22.
I mean, to be honest, he was balding at 21.
So. Yeah, he kind of looked older as well, right? But, I mean, the growth in Eriksen especially since Pochettino came in and he started running as hard as he does now and doing the extra things that he didn't used to do. But not just that, his vision and ability to spot a pass are unparalleled. His sensible use of the ball, mixed with his creative vision, make him one of the best and most unique playmakers in the country. And I think Barcelona were crazy to go for Coutinho and not Eriksen. Absolutely crazy. Coutinho is perhaps more of a poster boy, being Brazilian and good looking. But Eriksen, in my mind, is the better player.
I mean, we've survived without Toby and Jan, and we've survived periods even without Kane. But those games where Eriksen is missing, that's where we have a huge hole in our team. And even the latest game against Palace, he had an off match and the whole team is off. He really does make everybody tick.
Ajax, even at the Eredivisie level, took, probably three seasons to replace him when he left. There was a lot of kind of, you know, inefficiency on the technical director's part and all that. But it took until they got Hakim Ziyech last year for them to kind of get a proper person to proper kind of replacement in terms of the creative ability that Eriksen showed when he was 20, 21. And I remember like this quote from Frank de Boer, who said he has eyes in his back when you think he doesn't see you, but he sees you. And he's always, I remember one of his youth coaches talking about this as well, about how he always had to be moved up to older levels. So when he was 16, he was playing with the under 90s in Ajax. And he took maybe two games to adapt. And that was it. Once he kind of got the rhythm of it, that was it. What's the next step? That was it. And that, I think that kind of hunger to improve has always been a part of him. I actually think in terms of body language, there is an issue more with Eriksen sometimes than Vertonghen. But I mean, my impression of Vertonghen is built on the years at Ajax. But I think Eriksen is still just so mature beyond his years. And I to be honest, I do agree that I think in his first season I was a bit sceptical. And it's partly because, Vias Boas at the time was playing him out on the left. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, he's your best number 10 and you're playing Lewis Holtby instead of him. But I think I'm just really pleased with the way Eriksen's evolved and... he's always been a runner, but I think now he's very smart in his running. He's very good at kind of conserving energy when he needs to, but he will run any opponent to the ground if he needs to. And you saw that in the game against Juventus when, yes, they had injuries in midfield, but a midfield of Pjanic and Khedira, you don't just, neutralise them by not being good at what you do. And Eriksen is, I'm probably boring everyone with singing his praise.
It's great to hear you wax lyrical about him because we feel exactly the same.
And what I have to say is that left-hand side of Tottenham is very fertile ground. That's where we produced Gareth Bale, Luka Modric and Eriksen. They were all forced left before they're allowed to come in the middle. It's almost like we feel like we have to protect as someone who's quite technical before we fully trust them.
That's very true. I think that's a good point. I think we might see similar with Lucas Moura as well. As he becomes accustomed to life at Spurs. I'm glad you mentioned the Juventus game there, Priya, because I felt that Dembele... Dembele was amazing in that game as well. But the fact that Dembele was seen as man of the match in those kind of four games in a row overshadowed how good Eriksen was in the eyes of the media. And actually, I thought Eriksen was our best player against Juventus. I thought he was absolutely out of this world in some of the things he did. And it's nice to hear and get some praise for that.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We had a question from James Hedges on Facebook, who says, how do Ajax fans view us? Do they resent us buying their best players, or is there an affection for Spurs? And who do we buy next? That's something that comes up a lot, actually. we had similar questions from Tetrunk and Mark Lynch on Twitter, as well as Dan KP on Facebook. Who do we sign next from Ajax? And Tetrunk specifically said, De Ligt, will he be ready to replace Toby this summer? So I guess there's two questions there. How do Ajax fans view us, and who do we buy next?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's resentment, because I think at this point there is just a sort of acceptance with Dutch clubs that we're never going to, match the English clubs in terms of money or in terms of the wages we can offer. And obviously the level of competition in the Eredivisie is not as good as England. And even the kind of odd good performance, like Ajax's run in the Europa League, or the year that PSV really took Atletico Madrid to penalties. Those tend to be blips nowadays, which is a bit concerning, which is a bit depressing. But it is just sort of accepted that these players are mostly just produced to do well for the club, obviously, but they're also there to improve as players, and the end for them is that they will eventually be sold to a bigger club. I don't think there's resentment at this point. I think it's just more of wishing them well, and that's probably one of the kind of key changes in the attitude that I think Dutch fans have now, is that they just kind of wish their ex-players well and hold them close to heart. So I see PSV fans, you know, always liking what Memphis Depay does at Lyon, and supporting them through that, and even Dutch clubs on Twitter are like constantly kind of, you know, doing throwbacks to when all these great players are at their clubs. I don't think it's resentment for sure, because our best players are going to go somewhere anyway. So and the fact that four of the Ajax players and people like Moussa Dembélé have had success at Spurs definitely makes it kind of, you know that's a good example. So you always see these examples of how transfers from the Eredivisie always fail. You think of Vincent Janssen, obviously. But but it's nice to have a good example to counter that. And you have that in the form of the players that mostly Spurs have bought. I personally quite grateful to Spurs for making such successes out of the Eredivisie transfers, because I can always counter anyone who brings up Afonso Alves or someone with, oh, look at Luis Suarez, look at Vertonghen, look at Alderweireld.
So who's next? Nathan, who's normally on this podcast, is very, very excited by De Jong, and he wanted to know if you see Ajax accepting bids for him anytime soon.
Unless it's massive, say 60, 70 million.
Oh, wow.
Unlikely. Because both De Jong and De Ligt, I think, are under long-term contracts, and they're very young. And I think it will be at least a season, if not two, before one of them moves. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's De Ligt first, to be honest, because he's had Barcelona and Bayern follow him for a while now. And they can obviously afford those prices as well. Mm. I think most people would agree that he is likely to stay for at least another season, if not two, and will probably become Ajax captain in another season or two as well.
De Ligt or De Jong?
De Ligt. Mm. And it's De Jong, I like him, but I have an issue with the way football Twitter seems to portray him. There are literally tweets that say he will be better than Cruyff. There was an article on a website that's quite reputed, and I won't name it, but the headline was that he can be better than Beckenbauer, and I'm like, where are you getting these impressions from? Because yes, he's good, and I think the hype is because he's doing something that, one, he's young, and two, he's dribbling out of defence. But the kind of caveat there is he's doing it in the Eredivisie, where teams give Ajax a lot of time on the ball and they try to limit possession to their defenders, which is why De Jong at centre-back works, because he used to be a midfielder, for those who don't know, and he was only moved to centre-back in November against PSV. And he's been pretty good, but even in that time, De Ligt has been the better centre-back. And De Jong is currently... he's good, he has potential, but I do think he does... his future isn't at centre-back. He will move back to midfield at some point. I think he can potentially be a kind of Moussa Dembele-like player, but... it's obviously still pretty early to say. This Ajax team is very young, and they've just got a new coach, and we'll definitely have to give it a bit more time before we kind of assess this. But I do know from very good friends in who work really well with statistics, that De Jong comes out top on a lot of metrics that they have in terms of, you know, dribbling ability and passing ability. But I just really stress the caveat that it's the Eredivisie. And the irony is, whenever I hype an Eredivisie talent, I get these replies saying, oh, it's just the Eredivisie. And I'm literally telling you the same thing now. I mean, it's don't get crazy about a talent, and then because the people who kind of have to kind of suffer the collateral damage for it at the end are people who work like and write about Dutch football. So I will get a lot of tweets saying, you know, if something doesn't go well, oh, why isn't he doing well? Why isn't he doing well? And I'm like, well, yeah, but there, you know, there's always the caveat that it's the Eredivisie and there can be successes and failures. I mean, just to kind of summarise that, I definitely think De Ligt has a very high ceiling. And De Jong, someone tried to work out the number of forward passes that he was playing when he was in midfield and in defence, and it's exactly the same.
Oh, wow.
So it is not like he's making more adventurous passes. It's not like he's he's playing
just
the same role.
Playing at the back.
Exactly, he's playing the same role he played in midfield, but in defence. So it's a bit like a rotating kind of 3-man to 4-man defence, where in possession he goes up front and not up front. Sorry, he goes to join midfield and adds to the options there. But in defence he drops back, and I think the novelty of that. Well, not really the novelty. This has been done for many years and many teams before this. But I would exercise some caution regarding this. I do think he's talented, but we do need to kind of hold our horses on that.
Because in the Eredivisie, you have the ultimate golden child playing there at the moment, Martin Odegaard, the Real Madrid superstar. How's he getting on?
A bit of hit and miss. I think this is more of his level currently. So he's able to play matches and influence them, not very regularly, but now and then. So I think consistency is still something he needs to work on. But Herenveen have actually have a pretty decent few attackers in Reza, who's an Iranian striker, and Arbi Zendli, who I really like as a winger. And I think with Odegaard, I think he's kind of the big example that I'd say in terms of someone who's hyped up very much at a very young age and then isn't. Well, I don't know if it's the guidance or the way Real Madrid planned to bring him into the team, or if they had a plan. But I think currently, I think this is a good level for him currently to look to improve what he can do. And then it's basically the same as, you know, anyone like Eriksen or even Memphis Depay, I know. So you look to be the best at this level at the Eredivisie before you go and improve. And I don't think Odegaard is currently anywhere near the kind of top 10 players in the Eredivisie.
I mean, I think De Jong and De Ligt would take a good example using Davinson Sanchez, who had the opportunity to possibly move to La Liga or Barcelona, who's heavily linked there. But I think he mentions this could be nonsense, that he spoke to Pochettino and it kind of convinced him to come to Spurs as a more kind of a stepping stone onto greatness.
Yeah, follow the well-trodden path of Vertonghen and Alderweireld and come to Spurs and build.
And not join the monster of Real Madrid and Barcelona, where things are, it's a very different situation there.
Yeah, and I think you really can't underestimate the kind of pressure you'd be under playing in defence for. Thomas Vermaelen talked about this before the Chelsea game, where being a defender for Barcelona isn't as easy as everyone thinks. I mean, everyone thinks, oh, you just let the midfield have the ball, just put it up like to the other end, and you just sit back and, you know, have nothing to do. But defending with 50 yards behind you isn't as easy as they might make it out to be. And I think definitely that kind of I wouldn't be surprised if Eriksen kind of has that same progression in mind, where, I mean, I touch wood, I don't know, but in a few years he might look to move on to one of Real Madrid or Barcelona if they're interested in him. But the fact that he moved to the Premier League before that is absolutely invaluable, because you do gain a different set of skills and you try to, you know, become a more well-rounded player, become a kind of total footballer. I'm doing quotes in the air. Because that will then help you adapt to basically any team and in any league. Once you have the talent, obviously he has the natural talent, and you have the ability to be flexible in the way you play and the positions you can play.
Do you think this lack of flexibility is possibly Janssen's downfall? Because this was a guy, he broke the Dutch record of 20 goals in the second half of the season, and he seemed to have the ability to score goals, but he was unable to adapt to English football. But it's not just Janssen. There have been others. You've mentioned Alves and Kesman and Samaras, these kind of guys. They haven't been able to play the total kind of complete forward role that you need in England.
Yeah, and I think just the transition between leagues is quite an interesting thing. And I was at the OptoPro forum recently, which is a kind of analytics forum. And one of the talks there was by Ben Tovany, who tried to look at how difficult it is to, you know, for example, play a forward pass or play a final third pass in the Premier League compared to La Liga, or, you know, compared to the Eredivisie or the Championship. And the jump between the, I mean, without divulging too much into details, the jump between the Eredivisie and the Premier League is quite big. And I'm not entirely sure he ever got to settle in. And it's partly to do with the kind of lack of clarity in terms of the plan for him. I wasn't very clear on whether Pochettino wanted to play him up top and have Kane kind of in a number 10 role behind him, or whether he was just bought to be Kane's,
deputy.
Yeah, Kane's deputy. Yeah. Kane's replacement on the bench. And I think the kind of instability there might have played a role, and the fact that he didn't have a really like flying start at AZ, didn't have a really flying start at Almere City, where he was before that.
He was actually dropped. He was rejected by PSV as a youngster. He didn't make it there.
Yeah. But yeah, you look at, he followed what is kind of become the Klaas Jan Huntelaar pathway, because he was rejected by PSV as a youngster as well, came through there. And then he went to a club that was in the league below, and then came up with Heerenveen, and then moved to Ajax. So it was kind of that path. But I think with Janssen, it's just, I'm not entirely sure if he got enough time to settle in before he was kind of thrust into the spotlight. And he has previous in terms of taking time to settle into a club and getting his scoring boots on. And I'm just not sure if he was afforded that kind of confidence or time at Spurs. And the fact that he just wasn't impressive when he did play.
Yep.
He was good at the kind of, you know, holding up the ball and all that, but you signed him to score goals and he didn't do that, so it's perfectly understandable. It's a pity now that he's injured at, in Turkey as well, because, I mean, it's not like the Dutch have a national tournament coming up, that's fine. But it's just a pity for him in terms of his career, because this almost definitely means he'll be either sold in the summer or loaned out again.
I was going to ask you, because obviously I support Italy and my national team aren't at the World Cup either. So who are you going to support? Who are you going to be following?
Belgium, probably.
Okay.
Just because it's the kind of geographical neighbour. And well, I mean, for years, the Belgians apparently supported the Dutch when their team wasn't very good and wasn't making it to these tournaments. So might as well, you know, do the opposite and support the Belgium team. Or actually quite like Denmark as well.
Yeah.
So you've gone for the teams that have the Spurs players who come from the Eredivisie, basically.
Yeah. I mean, Denmark have Eriksen, but they also have like Lasse Schoene and Nikolai Jorgensen, who's at Feyenoord. And if Kasper Dahlberg is fit, he'll probably make the squad as well.
I really like the look of Dahlberg. He's someone I'd like to see in the Premier League at some point soon.
He's had a lot of injury issues this season, which has again been quite a pity. But he was very close to joining, not very close, but Ajax did receive a bid of like 50 million from Monaco for Dahlberg, to replace Kylian Mbappe on the last day of deadline day in the summer.
Okay. Going back to Janssen briefly, I mean, I'm at the point now where I'm willing to forgive you, Priya, for the false promises with Vincent Janssen. But I'm interested.
I was just excited by the fact that there was, you know, a narrative as the attacker who might actually come good after Luis Suarez in the Premier League.
But you've given us Davinson Sanchez, so I think it's time for all Spurs fans to let it go. And with that, I'm calling for Spurs fans to tweet Priya with I forgive you, Priya, as a hashtag. Because she's had a lot of abuse over Vincent Janssen. So let's do a nice thing. Hashtag I forgive you, Priya. We've got a couple of questions. We're running close to the hour mark, so I'm going to go with this one, which I liked, from Thomas Keane, TJPKeane89 on Twitter. How do fans of Vitesse feel about the Chelsea farm team situation? How about the rest of the Netherlands? Can you see this being repeated in the Eredivisie with others?
Well, I mean, it's kind of been a bit of a mixed reaction, I guess, where other teams and their fans don't particularly, you know, take very warmly or took very warmly to the relationship that Vitesse had with Chelsea, and that was mostly to do with the fact that behind the scenes it was an absolute mess where Merab Jordania, who did the takeover for Vitesse in, I think, 2010. He was backed by Alexander Chiriginsky, who is a Russian who has another Russian oligarch who has ties to Roman Abramovich. And of course, like UEFA state that no clubs under the same kind of ownership or senior management can play in the same competition. So that was actually something that came up in, I think, 2014 when Vitesse qualified for the Europa League, I think. And there was a whole kind of issue regarding whether they'd be allowed to play or not. That might be right. I might be getting my facts wrong here. But there was definitely a point after the 2013-14 season where they had quite a bit of confusion over whether Vitesse and Chelsea could play in the same competition. But it just has been a bit murky and fishy regarding that and the way that the relationship between the clubs work. But I think initially there was a kind of aversion to it because it was sort of dilution of identity, because you bring in like half a team of loanees and they have no kind of emotional connection to the club. They're not permanently employed by it. They kind of are, you know, their report back is to Chelsea, and that's who their club is. And there's the kind of worry that they're just here for the season and they'll go and then you'll get a new batch, but they still need time to get used to the club again. And you don't know if the new loanees are going to be as good as the old one. So Christian Atsu, who was a loanee in, I think, 2013-14, was really good. And then when he left, they couldn't replace him because the new batch wasn't as good. And then it took until, I think, the end of the season when Bertrand Traore started firing. So there is that, but I mean, Vitesse have recently kind of taken up that identity in some jest as well, I think they had a banner a few years ago where they said Chelsea B and proud of it or something of the kind, and it also starts to sound a bit hypocritical of the other clubs to talk about it as well, because Ajax loaned Traore from Chelsea, PSV have Van Hinkel. And quite a few Dutch clubs have, I think NAC Breda especially, have a few loanees from Man City as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite as dark or as seedy as the kind of City conglomerate where they've got all their teams.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's not quite as dirty as the Red Bull mission either. So I can kind of see it. It's not... Yeah, for me, I don't mind it too much. It's sending players out on loan if that's how they want to do it. There's the Watford, Granada, Udinese kind of link, the Pozzo family. So I don't watch a lot of Dutch football, so I don't put it on the same kind of level as the City conglomerate.
I think it's partly the fact that Dutch football, you know, the youth system bringing up our own players was one of the points of pride in a time where there is little else to be proud of in Dutch football. I think that was a sort of relationship that... was one of the first of its kind in the Netherlands. Well, I mean, they've had it in the past. Chelsea actually had a relationship with PSV in the past. But I think with Vitesse and Chelsea, there was just... For some reason, there was just a bit more of an aversion to it. And I don't think it was entirely independent... It was entirely without influence from the way the English media viewed it. Mm-hmm. And they viewed it as quite something that was wrong. And, you know, the fact that Vitesse are basically just running the Chelsea reserves. And I think that influenced, again, the Dutch public a bit. The Dutch fans a bit. But I agree, like, it's not as murky as the whole mm-hmm. City kind of group of a City football group where, you know, they've got Corona and New York City and
Melbourne City
as well.
Uruguayan team. And there was also Man United had a similar kind of deal, I think, in the 90s with a Belgian team, maybe Standard.
But it might be Anderlecht.
Antwerp. They sent a few players out there as well. So it's not a new thing. It's just...
No, yeah. And I think there's this perception that Chelsea buy in all their young players and farm them out, which in some senses is correct, but also the majority of their youth teams over the past few years have been at Chelsea for years and years and years, a decade basically. So it's a slightly unfair perception, and some of the players who are at Vitesse now or have been there recently have come through the ranks at Chelsea.
Mason Mount is doing really well.
He's a player I saw a lot of in youth football, and he's a really talented kid. I've got kind of high hopes for him as a future England prospect. So I'm quite glad to see him having a first-team opportunity and doing well out there.
Lewis Baker, who's there for two seasons, was really good as well, I think, especially in the second season, where he could have had the opportunity to kind of go to an English club, but he came back to Vitesse saying, because he did do well, but it was in patches. Mm-hmm. And he came back and he was like, I want to get a first team spot. And he did it. He was one of their main starters for most of that season, and played, I think, the year before when they won the KNVB Cup, the domestic cup. He played quite a big role and scored in basically every round other than the semi-finals and the finals, I think.
And that can only be a good thing for a player's development in terms of looking at it holistically from a national team perspective. Right, before I let you guys go, I do want some further reading from you, as we do each time. So what have you been reading or listening to that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
This is not related to football, but it's an article on the New Yorker. It's quite a long article. It's basically a mini novel, but it's called The White Darkness, and it's about story about a man who set out to cross Antarctica by himself a few years ago, and it is unlike anything I've read in the last year. It is amazing. It's not only the actual details of the journey and like what he was trying to accomplish, it was everything behind it and the way it was written as well. It was absolutely magnificent.
Lovely.
Mine is Asif Kapadia, who was the director who made the Senna film and the Amy film as well. He was on the Totally Football show, Golazzo Pod, where he talks about his new film about Maradona, which
That pod again? Sorry, does that pod exist? No, I quite like the Golazzo one.
Yeah, and it was a great insight into Maradona, the guy that took a team of nothing up against Inter Milan and Juventus in the late 80s, where these were three kind of unstoppable forces. There's political issues, there's like class issues, and it's a great podcast. It's just him and James Horcastle. And it's especially relevant now, given what Napoli are on the verge of doing again, like for the first time since Maradona was there. So I know Priya's a huge fan of how Napoli score goals. So it's a really nice podcast to listen to.
Their midfield is really good, Alan, Jorginho and Hamsik.
And Insigne. And only an idiot would not
Dries
play.
Mertens, of course. Dries Mertens, formerly of PSV.
Who is... he's having a great end to his career.
Don't get him starting on Italian football. I try and veer him off every time.
Well, I was about to stick the knife into Ventura, but I'll let it go.
My recommendation this time round is Seb Stafford-Bull's piece, 24 Hours at Wembley on Tottenham's Derby Day for Tifo Football, which is a beautifully written piece And I don't want to spoil it by telling you what it's about, but the title sort of gives away elements. But do go and read that. It's really excellent. Priya, thank you so much for your time and for joining us and coming down. It's been very much appreciated. An absolutely fascinating insight into all things Dutch football and beyond. Where can people read more of your stuff online?
Various places, but if you just follow me on Twitter, I tweet these out now and then.
Priya H. Ramesh, is that a reference to your central midfield number?
Yes, it was my favourite number, and my birthday is on the 26th of August, so 2 + 6 = 8, and I was born in the 8th month. So yeah.
Nicely done. And Bardi, as ever, is Bardi TFC. Thank you, Bardi. Good to see you, mate.
I had some Crystal Palace fans quite upset. They thought I'd forgot the H for Tottenham Hotspur.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. Give us feedback and ideas for talking points, and we'll try and be back next month. Thank you once again to Cave at SNK Studios. Very much appreciated, as ever. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. It's the Fight In. It's the Fight In. Clock. It's the Fight In. It's the Fight In. Clock. Oh, that was really interesting, mate, yeah.